Hi, I'm Trevor Elio.
And I'm Julie Stern, and this is Conceptually Speaking, the show where we interview experts to uncover the concepts and patterns that help us organize our world.
From farming to fashion, we can understand any field through acquiring, connecting, and transferring conceptual relationships.
We hope this podcast will inspire teachers and students to design creative solutions to complex problems and accelerate innovation in today's schools. If you're interested in our work, you can find out more at edtosavetheworld.com.
This week on Conceptually Speaking, Julie and I chatted with designer of wonder, Caitlin Krause. As you can tell, Caitlin doesn't like labels or nouns to characterize her praxis. They are too static, too inert to capture the intentional fluidity of her work. Though her current specialty is virtual reality, her focus isn't on hardware, it's on humanity. There are few people who so consciously and warmly center the experience, wonder, and connected potential of technology quite like Caitlin does. The focus of our dialogue today wasn't on the tech itself, but rather the relationships it fosters with ourselves, with others, and with our environment. In truth, it's our ability to live in those in-between spaces that makes Caitlin such a compelling designer of learning and leadership.
Jennifer Abrams talks about diving into deep ends and being in places that feel complex. And I think that people yearn for that, but they don't always have invitations to go there. So I like to be a person that kind of creates these experiences, and then I give a lot of credit to our human ability to kind of suss out what feels true and what feels right. And people have been in experiences with me and then said, wow, you know, I wouldn't have known how to do that on my own, but it feels like I've been yearning for something like this.
Whether you're keen on mindfulness practices or if you're a technology junkie, this is the episode for you. Not many people discuss cognitive science, Joseph Campbell, and VR headsets in the same breath, but I feel like EdTech would be in a better place if they did. We hope you enjoy.
Our guest this week is Caitlin Krause, a designer of learning and leadership who explores the intersection of technology and well-being. We're really excited to have you, Caitlin.
Hi, Trevor. Hi, Julie. It's great to be here.
Yes, for sure. Welcome, welcome.
So to kick things off, can you talk to us a little bit about your experience humanizing tech and designing wonder? I feel like it's a very interesting combination of things there.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think that sometimes when I talk about humanizing technology, people start and they picture a robot, and then I'm talking about something very sci-fi, which then turns into maybe, whatever movies we've seen that seem like it's a dystopian kind of view of how human meets machine. And then if I say the word wonder, then we might think about animated wonderlands and dreamscapes. So I like to build in the notion of designing wonder and prioritizing the imagination when we humanize technology, because the imagination is something that's a human skill and something that we need to keep alive and cultivate throughout our life. And to me, it really does define what makes a human special when we think about the future and advanced technology. So a lot of the lenses I look through are ones that incorporate mindfulness and storytelling and design elements, and not being afraid to embrace a new technology, even if it's one that we're unfamiliar with. You know, how do we move forward and do that mindfully where we don't lose our sense of well-being and just the chance to breathe and thrive in the process? So that's what I love to do.
Awesome. So we ask all of our guests to share sort of like three to five sort of core ideas. And Caitlin sent us a lot of different things to sort of think about and anchor. And I think what sort of rang true, the three words were mindfulness, wonder, and well-being. And, you know, thinking about technology, thinking about, so Caitlin is an expert with virtual reality and just super interesting technology aspects. So it's great to hear mindfulness, wonder, and well-being as your like core ideas. And so your first book, Caitlin and I met because we shared an editor with Corwin Press, who's moved on to a different section of editing. But anyway, she connected us, and that was years ago, right? At least 2 years ago, we met in person. which is really great. And your book with Corwin is called Mindfulness by Design. And then your latest book is called Designing Wonder. I love that they both have the word design in them. And I can't wait to talk a little bit more about Designing Wonder. So can you tell us about, so let's start with mindfulness, because that was your first book, Mindfulness by Design, and now it's Designing Wonder. Can you tell us a little bit more about why mindfulness and tech?
Yeah, definitely. And I must say it was fun to meet you too, because we were going to a conference and told, oh, you have to meet this person. So if you can imagine being at a conference of 1,000 people, and I was told, find Julie Stern. And, you know, right away when we met up, I felt like, okay, you know, not only do we have a lot in common, but I think that our vision for how to really integrate topics like mindfulness, I think, they've been a buzzword in the States for That's a while. Right. People have heard the word before. And, you know, how do you bake it into curriculum in a way that's thoughtful and also invites people who might not, let's say that we don't identify with the word mindfulness. We think that it means, like some people will say to me, they'll either say, oh, mindfulness means meditation, and I'm a really bad meditator. I can't sit still in a room. And I say to them, oh, I'm like that too. I can't, you know, I can't always sit still. And for me, the word itself. So when I went to write the book, I decided to title the book Mindful by Design, rather than the full Mindfulness by Design, because being mindful means to really take into account your own personality, to know that you can play the designer. It doesn't have to be cookie cutter, paint by number. And I, you know, I say that to anyone listening, if you ever hear what sounds like a prescription where there's step one and step two, and it doesn't seem to fit your lifestyle, you know, definitely for me, I push against that. And I try to say, okay, what's true to me? For me, mindfulness is that embodied awareness and that freedom of knowing that, okay, I don't have to put on a superhero costume to go in and play a role as an educator. Mindfulness kind of taught me to check in with myself first and to cultivate that inner landscape that was begging for more space, more reflection, more of my own practices. And I started to do mindfulness practices with poetry, and went back for my MFA and focused on poetry in the body. So the physical body and how our body is involved in the stories that we tell and the practices that we have. And it's really interesting. It wasn't a linear pathway for me. I didn't even identify saying this is mindfulness. But then afterwards, when I started going for workshops and I started studying some of the things that people who practice throughout history, some type of contemplative practice, it seems to go back to what now is being called mindfulness, which is, to me, I say the three A's: awareness, the idea of advancing past limiting beliefs, and that brings in growth mindset. And then the third A for me is authenticity. You know, how do we tap into what is really authentic about ourselves and other people to form relational trust? And, you know, how do we use that in education? So, yeah. So when I went to write the book, it was really because there was a need in education for that type of, you know, what Rachel Kessler calls the soul in education, like to come back to that wellspring of what goes beyond any of the, ironically, beyond the buzzwords, what rings true about human to human connection, and how we can build in intentionally some mindful design practices, incorporate storytelling, and also ease some needs of educators to feel met to the occasion when people are experiencing stress and anxiety and burnout. How could I introduce some practices that actually feed our wellspring first and then apply to students? Mm. So that's what I looked to do in the first book. And it was just great to meet you, Julie, along that journey of me writing the book and bringing it out into the world, you know, someone who's also walking that walk.
Love it. I love that just tiny difference between mindfulness and then just dropping the ness. And what's sort of the difference of mindfulness versus mindful, and that it's almost more accessible, I think, is what you're saying. And I would agree to that. Just being mindful, just being aware. That's something that I'm trying really hard right now. In this situation, I'm with my kids 24/7. This is not necessarily what I would choose in life. and so, I really, used to enjoy when they would physically go to school. But I think that, just mindful of like, we're in this scenario, we're in this moment. What do I want them to learn about being in difficult situations? So being mindful of myself as a parent.
Yeah. And there's no perfection. You know, I really think as parents, as teachers, when we start to animate that, I've listened to Brené Brown for years. And I think she talks about that kind of like the long distance runner, like how are we actually in this journey? And celebrating that, right now it takes courage. It takes courage to show up really as we are, whether it's in our family worlds, whether it's in our school practices, and know that, maybe this is one of those qualities of being right now where there aren't clear distinctions, and it used to be people say, oh, I have a work-life balance. It's like, well, our work becomes our life. And within that, I love to kind of explore with people and say, well, how are we creating some garden space? Like, I know you and Trevor talk a lot about, finding schemas and finding, what are some of the architecture of spaces? And I say, just imagine a garden space. Like, do you have that for yourself? And can you defend that space without any guilt, whether it's for you, a practice in painting or going out for a walk or a run. I'll ask people, this is a question I got from Parker Palmer when we were at a Courage to Lead program. He was leading the program and all of us around a circle, he said, what makes you come alive? And that's the way he started this, this retreat together. And I think just reminding us, not to forget what makes us come alive, what makes us animate and breathe, and how can we secure our safety belt first, even as we're meeting the needs of other people, or oxygen mask, whatever metaphor we want to use. But I think that for me, when I started to use those angles of mindfulness and not forget the social emotional needs that I have as a human who wants to help other people, then my practices became even stronger. My presence in the classroom became more animated, and that's what the studies show. Studies show that people who have some kind of practice that helps animate them, and you could call that a meditation or you could call it self-care, but your students and the people around you tend to feel it in a way that's just natural, that you don't have to announce, oh, I have a practice in mindfulness, but people tend to feel it from you because you have that equanimity. But it's not prescriptive. It's not like you can be good or bad at it. It's more of a, like, long range. It's just part of your values.
And these feel like practices that are just so necessary for educators, especially, doubly so in our current moment, because so much educational discourse around any sort of service oriented profession is, the old adage of, burning ourselves out to ignite the fire in others. And it's sort of just baked into the very language that we use to talk about the nature of our profession. And I think that's, just one of many factors for why teachers are getting burnt out. There's just sort of this expectation that if you are not dropping with exhaustion at the end of every day, then you aren't doing your most to be in service of students. And I think that for that reason, that the sort of practices that you're talking about, the frames that you're bringing, I think are really important for teachers to be aware and be in conversation with themselves as they move through their day and as they move, long-term throughout their profession.
Well, and I think to that point, a spirit of wonder and curiosity is a way to frame it where there's, I think what's interesting, and I know this for myself as a teacher, there was never a point when the work is done. Like there's never a point at the end of the day where you say, okay, I'm done, and it's a relationship. It's a relationship with yourself and with your students and with the people around you. So I needed to personally find a way to give that love and energy back to myself and say, the work may not be done, but there are ways to, for me, it's curiosity and wonder. There are ways to animate and also to see it as a practice where I'm learning and I'm creating and I'm sharing. And at the end of each day, I can say, yeah, I feel satisfied as part of that journey. Kind of as Julie said in the beginning, my awareness encapsulates this present moment right now. I might be focused on what I'm building tomorrow and the week after, and I might feel like I'm never really done. But if I can kind of encapsulate this moment right now, even right now, if I can appreciate being on this podcast with two of you, and I'm celebrating something that we're sharing in this moment that I could never do by myself alone in a room. And I think that's part of the magic of teaching. Like, there's always something that happens in that dynamic space that you couldn't predict. And if you can stay open and curious, mindfulness really teaches that curiosity over fear, and wonder associates with it, because you start to feel like, oh yeah, all of the identity that I thought was limiting about me. You know, Trevor and I talked at the beginning and I said, oh, I hate being labeled just as one noun, like teacher or, you know, runner, or, you know, how can I celebrate my own intersectionality and also the diversity that's in the room around me, and say, we each have stories to tell. We're learning from each other. It takes away the pressure I feel on maybe myself as needing to carry this experience for others. And I can kind of, I think through that relational trust, I've been really exploring how you can get a group collaborating and people saying, I feel empowered to share. I feel empowered to share. And suddenly that curiosity takes over. The sense of wonder kind of animates our human celebration. And I don't know if anyone else has had this experience who's listening, but I've had experiences where you just feel so lifted up that you're beyond yourself. Like, whatever, you know, you're beyond Trevor or Julie or Caitlin. It's like whatever you create in that space of learning becomes larger than any one person.
Does any of that align with like research on like flow states or anything like that? Because the way that you're describing that, John Vervaeke, who's a cognitive scientist, he has his PhD in like Eastern religion, Western philosophy, and all this stuff, and he brings together all of these different practices from these different parts of the world and says that the thing that they all have in common is like inducing this sort of flow state. Like you're saying, like this, the sort of, it is, you lose yourself in whatever, in either a practice or in communion with other people. So is there anything that you can kind of explore in relation to that?
Yeah. Sure. I'd say flow state, for people who are curious, you can look up the Osher Center. It's a Harvard Center for Integrative Medicine, and they're researching the flow state and also the idea of getting in the zone. Like, what does it mean to be an athlete in the zone? Mm-hmm. What's going through your brain? And the Eastern practices, this idea of being in flow, I feel it when I'm running sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful feeling, and I think it's also, you know, you can connect it to learning theories about how to be in that kind of sweet spot between rigor and relaxation, because, you know, and this is where, when we get into aspects of wonder, I have five facets of wonder that I've delineated in that book, Designing Wonder. The third one is called Surfing Wonder. And that's when you're kind of observing your thoughts, and you start out observing them, and then you start to lose your inhibition, lose your self-consciousness. And then you might have a feeling sometimes like you're just riding the waves of your conscious thought, able to capture little parts that kind of spark inspiration and cultivate them, and not feel like there's any voice of an editor or a critic. You just lose your sense of, I don't know, I guess it would be a sense of self-consciousness that might limit you. And I think with the brain and its ability, this is the capacity for a teacher. Like, this is why I think modern evaluation, you know, if we go back to traditional grading measures, that makes somebody clench maybe and feel as if it's a performance. And if we really want something to be authentic, then, you know, the person who's who's involved likely is not going to be helped by that measure. This is why I think, you know, you turn that into a different sort of experience where someone gets to know the conditions in which they thrive. You can set up with those conditions. And then when you start to get into flow state, the interesting part for me is I don't think this has to happen alone. A lot of people only feel comfortable in that state of flow maybe when they have a controlled environment. But what if you could get that state of flow happening in a team or in a group of collaborators? It takes trust. It takes a feeling of purpose. And then you create enough of a framework and you can just kind of let go, see what happens, start to have some buckets and anchors to collect the information, which is where I see learning transfer really coming in, some of what you two do so well. You know, and I have lots of case studies. I'm also doing work in virtual reality where people get together, and it's really nice because you can bring in things that you can't do in real life. You can bring in a three-dimensional object and you have something that's a memory capture and you're in a state of flow, and then you bring up this object and you can manipulate it or bring in music that's very evocative and have some kind of surroundscape. I think for people who are animated by spatial and maybe not as maybe something about two dimensions doesn't elicit that state of flow as much as our embodied experiences, you can start to really play with a loss of attachment to one way of thinking or one identity. You know, you can play with what it feels like to be an animal when you're inside of VR, and you can, you know, float down to the depths of the ocean and start discovering down there. So yeah, anything's possible. And you start feeling like, okay, maybe while I'm talking, people are picturing Alice in Wonderland or some type of different reality. But let's just say someone's having a really bad day and it's very frustrating. There's also research like, okay, you go into VR and your brain immediately, it's like, whoa, you know, where am I? Who am I? Mm-hmm. And suddenly a world opens as long as you feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about those? You said you break wonder down into five sort of, I don't even know what the word was that you used, but sort of five facets of wonder. Can you tell us? Yeah. Oh, that.
Yeah, you got it.
Can you tell us? Yeah, I love that. We did have someone on the podcast a few months ago about who talked about curiosity. So I like that you're using those words somewhat interchangeably, but that yeah. Someone like you has broken it down into five facets. I'm super eager to hear what they are. So you shared one, but can you tell us the five?
Yeah. And the five came out very naturally because I started talking with people. I knew that I wanted to write a book that was more of a conversation and less of a summation. So as I started talking with people, they were mostly in the fields of UX, so user experience design, people who had been gamers for a while, people who knew about the technology of virtual reality, and then also learning theorists and people who are in practices that have, let's say, like digital therapeutics, people who work on combating things like trauma or depression and use VR as well for that type of healing. So this state of wonder backstory, there have been studies out about what emotion fires the brain most intensely. You know, and this affects what we pay attention to. So you might notice on the news or on things that travel, sometimes the news that makes us feel anger is shown to be the most response friendly, which is terrible, right? Because it means that the more we can get angry as a society, then it's like, oh, we're going to be sharing that. And, you know, it's kind of nice to decode that, because then that makes me try to turn off that feed or, you know, try to be mindful again about what I let in that garden space of my attention. But the one emotion that is even stronger is awe and wonder. So not just happiness and joy is also very strong, but wonder means that you even rise out of yourself. So you have a feeling that when I'm looking at the facets, it just started to naturally, some of those studies, I saw, things are happening and there are really five prime facets of the way you could approach wonder. And then in the book, I introduce some exercises where people who are readers can say, how does that affect my day? So even though this book says it's about virtual reality, it starts with ways that you can bring that attention and that focus on wonder into your life, whether it's analog, whether it's yourself in a journal, piece of paper, and you travel out to the backyard. I wanted to make it also more accessible for people who might not have a headset or immersive technology to be able to say, this is what's happening in the brain, and these are ways I could learn about virtual reality because I'm curious. So the five facets, the first one I came across as really common with wonder is this intention and attention. So it's called the wonder of intentional attention. So an example would be just taking something simple in nature. Kids do this all the time.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
I wonder why, or I wonder about that. Or, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I was noticing that birds, they descend toward the water and then they kind of glide on the surface of the water, just a foot off the water. For a while before they land. I was thinking, I wonder why birds don't just like dive bomb right into the water when they're landing. Like, why do they glide on? And then I just looked it up, and there's something with the surface pressure, and it creates something that's energetically efficient for the birds. And we used to do this as kids. And sometimes I think this intentional attention, or if you say, I'm just going to sit and really look at this tree in the backyard, and I'm going to just focus on this tree, not a tree categorically, but like this specific one. I'm going to just celebrate intentional attention, just noticing maybe the state of the season that it's in, look at the tree and all of its roots and the way that they're across the backyard. Sometimes we just don't still our senses enough to be present with something. Mm-hmm. So that's the first wonder practice. There are different ways to foster that. And it's like an exercise for the brain. When you start to intentionally attend to something and focus your attention, you start to notice things that creep up that hadn't been there before.
That's so true. My 6-year-old is a nature enthusiast, and he can notice birds, insects, things like I wouldn't notice. And we just as you were talking about, I was thinking before you even said an example, I was like, today I saw him intensely looking at this little creek, and I was like, what is he doing? And there was a spider that was like crawling across the water, on top of the water. And I didn't notice it until I was like, what is he staring at? And he's so good at finding those things. And so, yeah, I think the practice, the advice I would give is hang out with young children, because they can do that for you for sure.
That's so good for our brain. Yeah. And then the second facet is the wonder beyond ourselves. So this is where VR can be really great. They have some experiences that, for example, there's one called Notes on Blindness, where you go in and you have an experience that's led by someone who's blind, and they show sounds as colors. And I think when you start to wonder beyond yourself, you start to see like, okay, I had some limiting beliefs. How do we cultivate empathy? Like, how do we really, we can say it, like say, I feel what you feel. But when you wonder, I think beyond the identity that we sometimes cling to or associate with, wonder gives us permission not to say, I'm curious about what that feels like and I'm going to look at it from the outside, but to kind of loosen our notion of me being limited to this one way of seeing that reflects the stories that I carry, whether it's from my childhood or from the labels that other people might have attached to me. And when you have a spirit of wonder, and you're, I think for me, it's part of why I love to read as well.
I was just thinking that there's so many books about, I love, you know, I don't know why I love this genre about slavery. It's just so interesting to me to read Toni Morrison, to read just so many books that like tell it from the point of view of someone who was enslaved. And it's just, it's so interesting. And even, you know, other cultures, people who live in far off lands. It's so interesting to sort of get into other people's shoes. I love when it's in this first person storytelling kind of way. That's like my genre of choice, just like taking me to this other world. It's really cool to experience what people thought. That's what's so great about books that I feel like movies can't do, that it's just like what you're in the mind of this person, which is really cool.
Yeah. And you start to have a feeling, I think, of possibility too, because they say empathy is understanding and then compassion is wanting to take action based on that understanding. So suddenly you start to feel like, oh, I have more agency than I thought because I saw beyond myself and I want to empower other people too. It's like, who thought this facet actually leads, I think, to maybe some of the ways to come together in communities and say, okay, we don't have to all be the same, but if we're curious about each other's stories and if we can want to step into each other's shoes, I think that's the first step to really listening and understanding each other, and not always feeling like we have to only project something, you know. So I think listening is kind of the hidden art with this facet number two. And then the third one is surfing wonder. We talked about that, kind of following the brain and the avenues that might be surprising that it goes on. So in the surfing wonder chapter, I do talk a little bit also about hypnagogia and this practice that people used to have before falling asleep. Like, I don't know if you've known, you have really creative thoughts sometimes when you're in that state, either of first waking up or almost falling asleep, because your brain is actually entering a different brainwave state. So VR can be great for that too, to kind of capture those thoughts that are coming that don't have a sensor and sound like they're fantastical. And there are all kinds of theater exercises and ways that you can access that wonderful creative side. So that's kind of neat. And then the fourth facet is the overview effect. And that has to do with stepping not only outside of yourself, but imagining. So astronauts came up with this term, the overview effect, because they were literally away from planet Earth, looked back on planet Earth and saw this beautiful sphere, and just immediately so many people who were scientists were reporting a feeling of awe, a feeling of wonder, a feeling of global oneness that is also like the levity and the gravity. It's also like, oh, you know, this power to come together past borders, past limits. It's like this humanness that sometimes I think we forget about it because we get kind of entrenched in whatever's happening in the moment. And I have the overview effect when I'm on a plane and I look out the window. I just think like, oh, you know, look at this amazing world and what we have, and also what's our place in it, right? If anyone's read Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, I think there's a quote there that says, you move from the world created for man to humans created for the world. Like, how do I fit into the world rather than considering the earth as my disposable present to use and abuse? So it's kind of nice with the overview effect. It couples really well with climate change and global stewardship. And you can even bring in, if you're using it in practices, you can have all of these outcomes in mind that have to do with sustainable goals and, you know, the global goals. But really, how do you make it personal and have someone have a feeling of a place in the cosmos? Like, this is amazing that we have a life here on this planet and that we're all humans and there's a common humanity. So I will say, if anyone's curious, please reach out, because there's an experience that just launched in VR where Edgar Mitchell, who was an astronaut, his voice has been brought into an experience where you can be in VR and go into the outer atmospheres and then actually into outer space in VR and look back on Earth, and you have the astronauts' reflections and a beautiful music track that are all creating this experience. So if you want to go to outer space and have an overview effect, they have this amazing experience that just launched.
That's amazing. Yeah, I remember seeing this this film. It was very short. Gosh, I'm blanking on the name, so I didn't want to mention it. But when you said that, but it was just about the astronauts who had gone to just film the moon. There were three guys, and one of them was the photographer, and his job was really just to take pictures. And they were just taking all this footage of the moon, and then they just turned around and took a picture of the Earth. And Trevor knows that picture is very special to my original co-authors and I, for a number of reasons, just talking about how that picture was actually the most profound picture that they took. And just hearing the three of them speak about that moment when they said, wait, we're here to film the moon, but turn around. And just hear them talk about it, I think I might have teared up. I mean, that's not very rare for me, but I was like, I am tearing up hearing these astronauts talk about that. So I will definitely be following up with you on how do I do that virtual reality experience.
I heard a story that the astronauts tell each other to carry a mirror, like you might forget, but carry one of those pocket mirrors, because when you launch, you're sitting and you're facing out. So you're facing out toward outer space. Mm-hmm. And one was telling, just hold up the mirror, because then you can look back at planet Earth and have this experience as you're going up of watching it.
It sounds like one of the affordances of VR is it, I don't want to say forces, it creates an opportunity for you to be radically present. And I feel like so much of modern life is about projecting into our past or projecting into our future. Thinking about, even if we are present, we are present in our phone and thinking about our past or our future. And when you were in VR and you entered into this, it's not disembodied per se, but I guess you're embodying this new state. It forces you to stop, check your bearings, look around, and sort of, I guess, recalibrate like your positionality wherever you are. And I feel like there aren't a whole lot of occasions in modern life that give us the opportunity to do that or create the conditions in which that can happen. So one of the things that I feel like keeps coming to the fore as you talk about this is design, where whether you're in a VR with a VR headset or whether you are outside in your back garden, thinking about how you can bring to bear all the resources in where you are and really use them to design an environment or create an environment that encourages you to be in connection with yourself and others instead of, you know, all of these other things. So could you talk about that role of design and being, once you're conscious and you're aware of these things, how do you design and create environments that encourage them?
Well, and I think it does start with that intention, and that it's actually a discipline. So it sounds like, oh, this might just happen, and it sounds amazing when it does, but it does take certain design elements. Actually, in Designing Wonder, there is a chapter about how to design that space for yourself as a creator and a creative, you know, how you can keep yourself really prioritized in the process, because then the next step would be for you to be a leader who leads other people through experiences that hinge on a sense of wonder. So how can you do that if you're not intentional about your own design practices? And for me, those practices are partly about the actual rituals that you have, whether it's a ritual of your day. I think we're all yearning for rituals in this time, because maybe our usual practices, whether it's a graduation at school or whether it's something that's an entry into the next phase of whatever we're doing, we really want to celebrate that. And so for me, I've come to have daily rituals that are part of my writing practice or part of my practice as a leader. And they really are, they're design elements that I bring in, whether I focus on the five senses and I'm intentional about making sure those needs are met and that they're uplifting in terms of the light and the physical space around me, or whether it's also the design of how you might create an interaction, like what types of questions are you asking? What types of tools are you using? We talk about the SCUBA method. And by the way, I'm going to harken back really quickly. The fifth facet of wonder actually hinges on this, and we didn't talk about it, but it's the wonder of the Gestalt. And Gestalt is a German word that really means that the sum is greater than the individual parts. So how do I intentionally design an experience? Like, here's a question that can be really challenging, but how do I design it so that there's enough freedom that each person's voice is going to take part in whatever we're building together? So I don't just see people as coming into to be a passive receiver of information, but how do I design for that wonder of the Gestalt where we feel like we had an experience together and each element played a part in creating that magic that feels like it was greater than the individuals. And usually in design, it starts with voice, with people feeling as if their voices matter, and with some type of interaction that you're building into the experience that has a social emotional component. So I talk about that in more detail in the book, but Trevor, I think it's a great question. And I think that the future is about that type of emotional design. Don Norman is one of my heroes, and with user experience, he's someone who's kind of one of the father figures in UX design that has emotion underneath it. So I do a lot of research about that in the book. And then it's fun because you can go into games or go into physical spaces and you start to look around and say, oh, I noticed what they did with the light there, or, you know, that's there. And I think things are built with purpose. So it's not just happenstance when you create a really powerful experience that somebody else can step into. It usually takes a lot of attention to the detail in the beginning, and then you can kind of let go when you're in it with them and see that magic happening for somebody else.
And I feel like it's nice what your five facets really contrast with, like, you know, Trevor and the team and I talk about this all the time with, like, gimmicks. I feel like so often teachers and even some consultants out there sort of they've preached these, like, fireworky type things to do for your students almost to entertain them, or and it just doesn't feel, I like your third word when you're talking about mindful by design, it's just the idea that, like, it's authentic and that you're mm-hmm. getting a lot deeper than, you know, fireworks or something.
Yeah, I call it's like pedagogical cotton candy. It's sweet, it brings you back more, it gives you a nice little sugar mm-hmm. rush, but it doesn't sustain you. And kids are in need of sustenance, I think, in our world today. They're surrounded by cotton candy and gimmicks and excitement and flashing lights. And one of the unfortunate things, I think, with the way the technology is often brought into the classroom, it is in a very gimmicky, sort of technocratic kind of way. And one of the things that I love about your work, Caitlin, is you center that awe, you center that connection. And technology should be a tool to help us do that. But so often it's not. And to the point where I love that you're conscious of that perceived contradiction. You're looking to untangle and sort of bring these frames together and say that the technology is just a tool that amplifies what humans can do. And what I think everything you've been talking about in this episode are things that we have, and I don't want to, like, romanticize the past, but I do feel like there are things that have existed throughout history in some way, shape, or form through different, you know, contemplative practices or religion or something that are kind of lost in our modern worlds, and we're obsessively atomizing and dissecting and fragmenting everything. And that's why I think that idea of Gestalt is so powerful. Go ahead. Could you maybe talk about that unteasing those frames where people see those things as dichotomous, but you see them as integrative and enmeshed with each other?
Sure. Well, I think I think that I also give people opportunities. You know, Jennifer Abrams talks about diving into deep ends and being in places that feel complex. And I think that people yearn for that, but they don't always have invitations to go there. So I like to be a person that kind of creates these experiences, and then I give a lot of credit to our human ability to kind of suss out what feels true and what feels right. And people have been in experiences with me and then said, wow, you know, I wouldn't have known how to do that on my own, but it feels like I've been yearning for something like this, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, so I think that for me, in terms of methodology, what I learned, and I put this also into this book because it seemed like the time was asking for it, is that we're all kind of emulating the hero's journey. And I think that right now, we're not only looking for heroes to go along that pattern with us, but we're looking for mentors to mentor each other and to play the mentor along the way. Mm-hmm. So when I take technology and say, okay, everyone's invited to have an experience that integrates with technology in a mindful way, I've been framing it with the hero's journey, saying, you know, imagine yourself, whether you know the work of Christopher Vogler or, you know, whether you're following a Joseph Campbell framework. We don't need to be prescriptive, but just basically saying, what if it's more like scuba? You know, we're scuba diving. And when you scuba dive, you need to feel like you can breathe through the experience. So that framework of how to mindfully approach new technology starts with an S for setting your intentions, kind of setting, even if it's stability, you're kind of setting yourself in this position to go into an unknown territory, but you're not alone. And if we're mindful and we're designing it, then the C in scuba is about crossing the threshold, whether it's into VR or whether it's into a contemplative practice, whether it's into our classroom. You know, that could be a virtual classroom is perfect for crossing a threshold into an unknown space that involves some kind of integrative technology. And the U is really in scuba where I see wonder and mindfulness and imagination playing a big part, because that's when you're riding the ride. You're maybe feeling as if you're under the experience because you're in a deep zone, and it could be that you're downloading information. It could be that you're practicing some type of engagement, but sometimes you're in the experience and you don't have an opportunity to step back from it. So that's what the B is all about in scuba. It's about actually coming back from that experience that you had, and the A is for application. How do we transfer? How do we apply it? How do we make meaning of it? And this is where, again, you know, I feel so inspired by your work, because even in this new book that you have, you talk about the frameworks and you talk about patterns and ways to make metaphors. And I like to say to people, if you're coming into VR experiences, your focus hopefully won't always be about VR. Like, it's wonderful that it is VR, but I'm not technically just teaching about VR as the tool. I'm teaching about what the tool can do. So when you come back and you're applying that, you could be having an experience. It happens to be in VR if VR fits the meaning that you're trying to get across, whether that's traveling to another place, whether it's world building, whether it's about math and making some concept into a three-dimensional image and you're showing it. You know, it could also be in science and you're doing some type of experiment in VR, but then coming back and being able to transfer that understanding is really what I think the brain wants to do, and what then builds in a meaning that you carry with you for your life. So with this idea and, you know, laying out the scuba kind of framework, I think it builds in an architecture where people can say, okay, I now have a way to go on a hero's journey when I'm encountering new technology. And people have said to me, they feel more comfortable, more curious, And the interesting part is I can play the mentor and other people can play mentors for others and feel like we give other people that magical elixir. So when they're encountering something new, they don't feel like they're out in the woods by themselves and that they're alone in a process that can be intimidating. And I think that's a side note. I think technology, we all have our relationship with it. If you were to draw a picture of your relationship with technology, some people say right now, like, oh, it's a very dysfunctional relationship. Like it's just a monster and it intimidates. And I think that's really human too. So I like to not just demystify the tech, but say, hey, we're in this together. We're in this as co-learners. And it's not about perfection or needing it to be a polished experience. It's more about feeling like we're on a scuba dive together and that we can help each other along the way.
I love that. That's really cool. I wanted to ask you, I know we're coming at the end of our time together, but I wanted to ask you if the average person in, do you find in the field of virtual reality, do you find that your take is very different from the average sort of conversation? And if so, how do people respond, react?
I find, gosh, it's a great question because I've started working with the Virtual World Society and I've been involved in different programming. And I'd say what's really nice is that the whole community in virtual reality is really supportive and it tends to attract people who are dreamers because it's all about going into different spaces. And here's something interesting, and we can play along. If you're listening, I invite you to play along. But the first time you put on a headset, I'll put on an imaginary one right now. Usually your body does something and it involves what I call wonder face, where you go like, and you see this over and over. People put on VR and their mouth tends to open. And there's this new theory that's totally plausible. It has to do with the brain, but we form open body shapes when we're in a spirit of openness and amazement. So no doubt you start to like, you know, you get very open, you know, and this is amazing, right? That throughout time, our body opens up when we feel accessible. And so when I'm in VR or when I'm working with people or interacting with people in the VR field, I think I feel embraced and I feel as if I have a voice there that might be accessing something that I would call interstitial. We need more conversations that are between building bridges between topics. I tend to stand for the intersection between science and technology and humanities. And so far people have definitely fed back gratitude and positivity my way, because who knows? It just could be that this is the time when the world seems to be asking for that. And, you know, and that's part of my mission, you know, to take my passion and kind of combine it with what seems to be the world's needs at the moment. So virtual reality is a nice landscape for that. And I say, let's not form a silo there that's not accessible to the rest of the world, because there are some beautiful ways to kind of go in between, around and within VR, so that people who have never had a headset but still have experiences with wonder, well, maybe they can cross over into that threshold and also have people in VR able to see how storytellers and human-driven connection can happen also in the spaces outside of the headset.
It really does seem like it's looking at how being human and the human condition are on the one hand so rooted in sort of in tradition and history and culture, like, you know, Joseph Campbell's monomyth is essentially the idea that there is some common thread through each culture, but at the same time technology is giving us new ways to be human if we are open to them, right? So like a kind of like a interesting post-humanist idea, but It's really interesting and exciting for me to hear the way that you think and talk about technology, because I think that's something that is so needed right now. Like currently the technology that I am dealing with in the classroom on a daily basis removes me from some of those things. So it is affirming to me as a classroom teacher to hear the fact that there are people out there in the field who have the I don't want to say the right perspective, but have a very human focused perspective on technology, which is something that I feel like is so, so needed. So I appreciate you and your time and sharing your wisdom with us. So it's very fascinating stuff. It's unlike any other guest we've had on the podcast, I think, and unlike most conversations that I have with anyone about technology. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm so grateful. Like, gosh, Trevor, the word connection comes to mind, you know, and I do think that tech can be a great tool for connection, and it should be a time that we also keep ethics as part of the equation. Like, what does it mean to use it for good and to ask all those big questions? Because we're at a period of change right now that's going to become even larger. So if I can play a part in animating that discussion, I feel really grateful.
For sure. Where can people find more? Do you have a one-stop shop website? I know you're on Twitter and things like that, but where can people go to find out more?
I think my name is the best guaranteed hub to reach me most efficiently. So CaitlinKraus.com is my website. Mm-hmm. And then from CaitlinKraus.com, I have Designing Wonder as one of the areas. I have Mindful by Design. And I also built in, if you want to subscribe to that website, I put out a newsletter about once a month where I include some of the recent research I've come across, so that as I'm doing work in the field, I can bring it back to that community and have people reach out to me personally that way. So thanks, Julie.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, it's definitely your space of, you know, sort of humanizing technology and designing wonder, I think, is such an emerging space. And I think that we will have many more conversations, I hope.
I can't wait. Yeah. Thank you both. And just cheers to everybody listening too. I feel like this, we've animated all of these different topics and managed underneath the umbrella of mindful technology and designing wonder, it just kind of thrives there. So I feel like we created that garden tonight. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Conceptually Speaking. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and are coming away with a stronger grasp of the concepts and mental models that help us understand our world. If you like this podcast, feel free to like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platform. If you want to learn more or get involved, check out our website at edtosavetheworld.com and join our Facebook group, Learning the Transverse.